Welcome to Nature Bats Last in the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This August 11th, 2015, episode 50 of Nature Bats Last comes live from Guy in the Mud Hut, as well as me, Mike, from Tucson this week. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrozen. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This week I'm house sitting and I have cable, which is something new for me. And I got to watch a little bit of Bill Maher's show the other night, and he had on climate scientist Michael Mann. And Michael Mann is one of the leading scientists in the climate world. And he interviewed him and he said a couple things which I thought were pretty interesting. And Bill Maher's first question was, they were talking about Obama's clean energy plan to be implemented by 2030. And Bill Maher said to Michael Mann, he said, "Won't we be dead by then?" And Mann proclaimed, "No, the good news is we're still at the point that we can make cuts we need so that we don't get irreversible climate change." What do you think about that guy?
Well, it's pretty amazing considering just a week or so ago, Michael Mann, one of the two most famous climate scientists in the world, along with James Hansen, concluded that we were in the exponential stage of climate change, that we're beyond linear, that we have entered the arena, without saying the words, of course, of abrupt climate change. So it seems a little sketchy to me that a week ago it was truly horrific news, and this week it's no big deal.
I think things change when you're on TV.
They certainly do for me.
It's interesting because he really seemed nervous, and Bill Maher seemed really matter of fact, like he always is. But Bill Maher was actually the guy who seemed to know what was going on, and Michael Mann seemed to be painting over this glossy hope, which, you know, hey, the classic line, it's not too late if we start right now.
Yes, of course. It's always 2 minutes till midnight. It's been 2 minutes till midnight my entire life. I think maybe the clock is broken.
I would have to agree. I think the clock is broken. And I thank Scott Andrews for actually posting part of the dialogue on our Facebook page so we could bring up that topic. And we'll talk more about climate later in the show. But first, we have our guest today, a very special guest, Daniel Quinn. And Daniel is best known as the author of the novel Ishmael, which has been published in more than 25 languages, and the winner of the 1991 Turner Tomorrow Award, the largest prize ever given to a single literary work established to encourage authors to seek creative and positive solutions to global problems. It's used in classrooms from middle school to graduate schools in courses as varied as philosophy, geography, history, religion, biology, archaeology, zoology, ecology, anthropology, political science, economics, and sociology. Mr. Quinn's other books include The Story of Bee, My Ishmael, and Beyond Civilization. He and his wife and painter, Rennie McKay Quinn, lived in Chicago, Madrid, New Mexico, and Austin, Texas, and are currently residing in Houston, where he frequently meets by telephone with classes in which his book has been used. Welcome to Nature Bats Last in the Progressive Radio Network, Daniel Quinn.
Glad to be with you.
Speaking of students and teaching, both Guy and I, Guy's professor, former professor, and I'm a former high school English teacher. And I started my last year of teaching with a question to my class, and it was based off your book, Ishmael. And I asked my students why they were in school, what they thought the requirement for them being there was. And we went through various answers of, you know, they had to learn the basics, they had to get a job, they had to learn critical thinking. But as I kept asking why after each of these questions, it really came down to the point where they kind of came up with the answer because they needed money to eat. And looking back at your book, and the phrase that sticks in my head is, we are the only species that locks up the food. And I was wondering, when you speak to classes, it seems that some of the things that we take for granted they're just a given, and we don't look past them. And that's what kind of what the dominant culture does, is what you call civilization. I was wondering what your experiences have been with talking with students and teachers.
Oh, it'd be hard to characterize. I've just hit off the top of my head, I've noticed that most of the conversation, most usually conversations with high school students are more exciting than with college students. I have no explanation for that. They seem to be brighter, have more wider ranging questions, and the college students tend to be more conservative.
That's very interesting. I would have thought it would have been the opposite.
Yeah, I would have too.
Actually, I wouldn't. I think that as students get older, they become deeper in the rut. They become more entrained within the system. And yeah. So I'm not even. I suspect if you talk to fifth graders, they actually would have a lot of very interesting questions.
Now the very first class I met with happened to be a first grade class, not by telephone. This was in person, and one of the first questions asked me was, they knew that I'd won the Turner Tomorrow Award, and one of the questions was, "What did you do with all that money?"
Oh my! So it starts.
No,
when
no kidding.
They don't know anything about book sales, apparently, huh? Or publishing.
So apparently, when you're 6 years old in this culture, you know that money is the most important thing of all.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, do you find that when you, it seems to me when I talk to students, and we've really come to a place, at least in my classes when I was teaching and I left 4 years ago, that we really didn't have a choice. You know, we were kind of born into this living arrangement, you know, civilization, and it feels like a predicament. And what happens with a lot of my students and with my friends as well is they almost come to a place of being overwhelmed by it. Because they feel that, you know, it's a predicament and there's not a lot they can do about it. Do you have people asking you a lot about what they can do?
No, I can't say that is a frequent question.
Do you feel that, I mean, did you feel overwhelmed when you started to come across, you know, delving into this work and really starting to look at the dominant culture and realizing what civilization was and what it's doing? Did you go through any stages of sadness, or, and if so, how did you deal with that?
Well, it was a gradual process with me. I spent 20 years trying to find answers to all the questions you see addressed in my books. Mm-hmm. And so it was very gradual. And it wasn't something that came upon me overnight. And when I sat down to start writing, I knew I had something to say, but I didn't know what it was or how to go about it, which is why it took me 12 years to write the book, write Ishmael.
Right.
It went through 8 separate versions, and Ishmael was the 8th.
And so were there peaks and valleys for you emotionally during that, those 12 years?
Was I what?
Were there peaks and valleys as far as the writing goes, as far as, you know, emotionally, you know, you were kind of, in a sense, breaking new ground?
Well, you know, every time I said, well, it didn't work last time, but this time it'll work. And so I started out, you know, always hopeful, and worked on it for a few months, and I said, well, That didn't do it either, so I tossed that in the wastebasket and said, well, the next one will do it.
So were there any significant influences for your life or for that book specifically? I mean, surely you had major influences. And if so, how did they influence you? How did they influence the writing of that book?
I didn't really. I had so many influences I can't really point to. It was assembling a vast puzzle, a mosaic, and I got a piece here and a piece there and a piece there and a piece there and a piece there from, you know, hundreds of different authors, but not one who helped me put it all together. That was a chore I had to do myself. Farley Mowat's book, People of the Deer, was a very key work for me. So was Marshall Sullins. Now that I brought his name up, I can't think of the name of his book. I'll forget that. There were many different sources.
How about today?
And when you're writing, or at least in the early part of writing, as I understand it, you were here in New Mexico, which is where I live. Can you comment about that experience and where specifically you lived and whether it had any influence on your thinking at the time, living in a pretty remote, poor state by most standards?
Yeah. My parents died, and I had an inheritance. It seemed much larger than it was, but we thought, well, let's get out of Chicago. I need to be in a desert to write this book. I don't know why I thought that, but I did. And so we headed to the first desert we thought of, which was New Mexico, and we spent a long time driving around, looking at places to live, to buy and live in, and we finally ended up in a little town in between Santa Fe and Albuquerque called Madrid. They don't say Madrid. They say Madrid, not Madrid. And this is a town. It was a former ghost town. Had been a coal mining town, and it was nothing but coal mining. And there were about 25 miners' shacks that were being renovated by people who came in and just sort of sat down and did it. They sometimes bought them for a few $100s, and we bought a second generation, one that had already been converted to a large extent, but it was still very, very cheap compared to things in Santa Fe. There everyone was poor, way below the national poverty level, but no one was poor because everybody was poor. We never thought of ourselves as poor, but by the national average, we would have been considered very poor indeed. And this was a good place to live. It was unusual. There was no political structure, no mayor, no police department. So we had to look after ourselves, and we looked after each other. After we left, it has become quite a tourist attraction. Sort of is lost the character that it had when we were there.
It sounds like it's not that different from where I grew up. A very small town focused on timber extraction. So this was the 1960s and early 1970s, and there was no mayor, there was no town council. I think there was a county policeman who lived nearby, but it was a situation in which everybody knew everybody and tended to take care of each other in a it takes a village sort of way. So did that influence your perspective on anarchism and tribalism? Because I can't imagine that it didn't influence my perspective on those topics later in life.
Actually, in the last few years we were there, we had a newspaper. Rennie and I started a newspaper called the East Mountain News, covering all the news east of the mountains that are west of Albuquerque. What are the the Sandia Mountains. So we had a area that was about 1,000 square miles, size of Rhode Island, just covered by one newspaper, 11 different cities.
Wow.
And it was a very tribal newspaper. We didn't think of it in those terms, but it was. We were all more or less equals. Rennie was the boss, and she had the worst job of all. none of us had a salary. We had two other people work with us who wrote stories, took pictures, and sold advertising. Of course, you've got to sell advertising if you're going to have a newspaper.
Right.
And the money that we brought in was what kept us all going. And when we didn't have much advertising, we printed an 8-page paper. We had a little more advertising, we printed a 12-page paper. And we had a lot of advertising, we printed a 16-page paper. And we had a little more money to divvy up at the end of the week. And that's one of the models I used in Beyond Civilization for as a tribal business.
Right, I do recall that, actually.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And it was
Beyond,
fun.
Beyond Civilization
really
was an explanation for Ishmael, in a sense, wasn't it?
Oh, I don't think so. It didn't.
It seemed to me that I remember reading somewhere, and maybe it wasn't from you, that people somehow didn't understand Ishmael or exactly what the point you were trying to make in some cases, and it almost felt like Beyond Civilization was kind of answering some of those questions.
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. The story about that is that I allowed a group of people to come down and sit with me for a weekend asking questions. And I said, okay, but first I want you to read this new book, Beyond Civilization. So I made sure they all had copies of Beyond Civilization, and they read it, and they came down, and they sat down, and they had no questions.
So it was a short weekend.
Yeah, right. It was a social weekend. We just sat around and gabbed and just sort of foozled the time away. That book just answered all the questions they had come with.
Well, that's amazing. It's even more amazing to me that three works of fiction didn't do the trick, but that a work of nonfiction covered the whole thing.
Yeah.
You mentioned in our correspondence that only 10% of the people that have read Ishmael have read other work by you, and is that frustrating?
Oh, very frustrating indeed, because I know, and those who have read the rest know how much they're missing.
Right.
But people, I think they feel that what more could they possibly be except what's in Ishmael? It just couldn't possibly be anymore. So they think I must just, like some New Age writers, just write the same book over and over again with a different title.
Yeah.
But that isn't the case with me, because I thought when I wrote Ishmael that I was done.
Yeah.
But when I started hearing from readers, I realized that I wasn't done and that another book was needed. And I wrote My Ishmael. I met with a rabbi in California, wrote to me and had read Ishmael, and he wondered if he could bring me to California to meet with an ecumenical group of priests, rabbis, and other ministers who had read Ishmael. They wanted to talk to me. I said, sure. So he put me on a plane, and I came out there. But in fact, the rabbi really had his own agenda. He wanted to get me face to face when the whole thing was over and say to me, you have undermined the faith of my lifetime. And I want to know what you can give me to replace it. I was completely flabbergasted. Of course, I had no answer for him. But I realized I had to work on that. And that was the origin of the story of B.
Right.
I probably wouldn't have written the story of B if I hadn't had that experience. I realized that I had to give him an answer, and I did in that book. At least I felt I did.
Yeah, that's a pretty heavy load to carry.
Yeah, really, really, yeah.
To say the least. And so, you know, Guy and I, we both write and talk a great deal about civilization, where it's taken us. And when we talk to people, a lot of times we kind of get flippant comments, like people, you know, they'll say, well, what do you expect us to do? You know, go back and live in caves. And I was wondering what your thoughts were about, because everybody seems to think progress is just vertical. And, you know, and we have to move forward no matter the consequences. And it seems to me that, you know, through your writing, that there's almost a different version of progress, that it doesn't have to always be vertical and going up and moving forward. It can kind of go off to the side. And I was wondering if you could comment on that a little bit.
Well, yeah, I think so. It's my notion that so much of the devastation that we work upon the world is that we are a very lost and deprived people. We fill up our lives with expensive toys and spending money and getting things and building houses and trying to find something to fill up the empty place. Mm-hmm. And that many of the people who see the need for change really see it as a matter of giving something up, giving things up, giving up a lot of stuff. And I've tried to say, no, it's not about giving up stuff. It's about getting something else that you really need, something that is really important. And that you can do that if you head toward a new tribalism. And I've talked about the new tribal revolution in a couple of books in My Ishmael and in Beyond Civilization, which is not an organized thing, but is a matter of people finding a different way to make a living, because you can't just walk away and do nothing, which is what the kids in the 60s and 70s found out. They talked about having a revolution, but they had to eat too, and the revolution didn't give them any way to eat. Mm-hmm. And so they eventually ended up getting jobs. And what I, in Beyond Civilization, I tried to point a way for people to walk away to something else, not just away from something, something better, something that's more meaningful, and leaving, not trying to destroy what's here, but by diminishing it, we leave them alone and let us go somewhere else, do something else. And it's a matter of, as I said, it's the name of the book, Beyond Civilization.
Right.
But it
seems to me that many people, perhaps even most in this culture, believe there is a single way to live. And this...
Oh, for sure. You know, that is one of the great memes of our life is we have the one right way to live, and there's no conceivably better way that people could live. We must live this way, and we've got to go on living this way even if it kills us.
Right, and you know, we're on the verge. It seems that the progress,
sure,
as we often interpret it, is progressing right toward the gas chamber.
Absolutely.
And it seems to me that people have great difficulty distinguishing between needs and wants. So that brings up a question for me. How do you differentiate between human behavior, what's within us all, and cultural behavior? Or at this point, can they even be differentiated?
Well, I've never really looked at the question that way. I look at the people that we have displaced, taken away their lives, that I call labor peoples, people who live at the hands of the gods, leave the running of the world to the gods and takers. We are the takers who've taken the rule of the world into our own hands. That they were people, but they had a different culture, entirely different culture from ours.
Right, and I think that leads directly to your conclusion, countercultural though it is, that there is more than one way to live, and that that most people can't see that.
Yeah, there is no one right way for people to live.
Yeah, it almost seems to me that many of us, obviously all of us that are born into civilization, we almost have this, you call it takers, it's a conqueror's mentality, it's a conqueror's outlook, in that we've turned our wants into needs almost. That's how it feels to me, that we think our needs and our wants are the same thing.
No, I've never thought of it that way.
So you meet with a lot of, obviously, different, you've met with teachers and students and people, are writing you and asking you to meet often and things like that. Do you have little time for anything else besides responding to interview requests about explanations of the world and culture?
I get about maybe 25 requests for telephone conferences a year, and I would do more if I had more requests. It's something I really enjoy doing, and it's something I know that's important for the kids. I'm told that they really get a lot out of it. Something that I really enjoy. But I got a woman. She was doing a college paper, and she wanted to interview me. And I said, "Well, okay, I'll be glad to work with you. Why don't you send me a set of questions, and I will answer them. It'll take me a lot more time than if we do it over the phone, which I can just do it off the top of my head." But this way you'll get real answers that you quote and that I can stand behind, and that you won't have to remember what I said.
Right.
And it was obvious that she had a very spiritual nature. She was obsessed by spiritualism. And she sent me her questions, and I spent a good 2 days writing answers to her questions, never heard a word back.
Apparently you gave the wrong answer.
She was obviously very disappointed in my replies. They weren't what she was hoping for.
That's hilarious. This is Nature by Class on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Guy McPherson, and along with Michael Sliva, we're having a conversation with the award-winning writer Daniel Quinn today. Your books present many questions, and your readers ask many questions about your work. It seems that on some level, at least, you've created a culture of questioning with your readers. And at least in this country, and I would argue in the dominant culture more broadly defined, questioning is not encouraged, and it certainly is not celebrated. That makes you a square peg in a round hole. Have you thought about that, and how have you thought about approaching teachers who are promoting the dominant culture with that in mind?
No, I never thought of myself as that in those terms. It's interesting. Now I'm thinking about what you said instead of answering. I'm not sure I really understand your question, though.
Well, this culture does not encourage people to ask questions.
Yeah, I understand that.
And it seems like your work, starting with Ishmael, was all about encouraging people to ask questions. And so there's a disconnect there, in that you're encouraging people to question every aspect of their lives, every aspect of this culture. Yeah. And you know, I was in the public school system for a long time. Questioning is not encouraged. It's actually discouraged.
Oh, no. Oh, so yeah. It's one of the things you learn is don't ask questions.
Right. Yours is a disconnect. So when you meet with teachers, when teachers call you on the phone, when they want you to connect with their students, does that ever make for an awkward feeling that you have students who have never been encouraged to ask questions? And
oh,
you're working
no. I think that Ishmael is the book. 99 times out of 100, the book that's used is Ishmael. And the teachers who want to use that book are comfortable with asking questions, or they wouldn't use it. So that's never a problem.
Is there a pushback ever from have you heard back that there's been some pushback from maybe their administrators or school boards because they're using your book?
Very rarely. It has happened, yeah. It's always, of course, from people who've never read the book.
Right. Well, yeah.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. For me and my students, Ishmael was a launch pad, and, you know, we've read everything since. But maybe that's what we talked about earlier, was that younger students or students and not adults seem to crave and want more, instead of thinking, well, this is just the answer, Ishmael. Could there be any more said? And it seems that the students, in my experience, have gone on and have read more and have gone to other authors. But the launch pad was Ishmael.
Now, one of the things that I always have to guard against is having the teacher censor the questions.
Mm, yeah.
And I specifically tell them, you know, that they should, kids can ask anything at all they want to know.
Right.
They should ask. And I would rather they didn't preview the questions. And just the last telephone conference, I said, the teacher came back and said, well, yes, I understand you perfectly, but I just want to make sure that something or other, that they don't ask anything that might be an embarrassment to the school, some bullshit like that.
Yeah. And there's an underlying fear in public schools.
Yeah.
And the culture in general, I think.
I went back and I said, look, If you tell them you're going to preview the questions, they are going to censor the questions themselves.
Right.
They know how to do that. They know what the teacher wants to hear. So do not, please, do not do that at all. Just trust them. I think you can trust them to ask the questions that will be okay. And, of course, they were. But many teachers are afraid to let them go.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's part of the main reason why Guy and I eventually left public education, was this underlying fear of, you know, something could possibly go wrong, or you could lose your job, or, you know, somebody might say something that's embarrassing. And it was just so prevalent. And I came across your work right near the end of my teaching career, and I'm thankful that I did, but I wish I would have come across it a lot sooner, because I may have done some things different in hindsight in my classroom.
You'd have taught yourself out of a job in a hell of a hurry.
Yeah. I might have only taught 2 years instead of 12, right. Well, is there anything else you're working on at the moment, Daniel?
Well, I've done, my teaching career is over. I've said everything I have to say. But I'm still a writer, and I'm still writing. And I went on after those four books to write After Dachau, a novel, To Hold Thee, a novel, The Man Who Grew Young, another kind of a visual graphic novel.
Right.
And I just finished a new novel, and we'll be doing others as well.
Oh, we look forward
to it. And where can we find your work? Where can our listeners find, where can they access your writing? Do you have a website, for example?
Oh, sure, ishmael.org.
Right.
Then they can. There are about 600 questions that are answered there. It seems incredible that people would have generated that many questions, but actually we've gone through and winnowed it out. There are more than 600, but it's down to 600 now.
It's an excellent resource. It really is. I've gone through those questions.
It's an enormous. It's a dinosaur. It's simply huge, enormous. It's not an attractive website. It needs to be revamped, modernized, and all that. But I haven't got the energy for that right now. I don't think I care deeply enough to do it.
Yeah, it seems you have
perhaps one of our listeners
would
volunteer their idea.
Yeah. Well, I've got an excellent webmaster who if I ever decide to do it, will do it. I have a Facebook page and which I neglect.
That's not a bad thing sometimes.
A page on Goodreads.
Yeah. So well, we thank you for your time, Daniel. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and we look forward to your novel, and we encourage people to go to your website, ishmael.org, and check out the questions and answers.
Yeah.
And I have one more question, if you don't mind, before we wrap. If you were to recommend books and films beyond your own, what would they be?
I should have printed out a list of my recommended reading.
If we can find that at ishmael.org, that's okay. You need not scramble to answer on the phone.
I will put up a. I don't think there is one. Oh, there is. What am I saying? Of course, there is a section of recommended readings up there already. Yes.
Excellent.
I think one of them is Derek Jensen's A Language Older Than Words, if I recall. So.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I wrote the first. First blurb Derek Jensen ever got for that book.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you again, Daniel. It's been an honor talking to you. And,
well, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for your work.
I thank you for the invitation.
Thank you very much.
All right. That was author Daniel Quinn of Ishmael, and the famous phrase goes, read Ishmael. You see bumper stickers and people tag it all over the world. I think you should follow those directions.
And I actually went to ishmael.org yesterday to see what was new there, and I couldn't get in. The website wouldn't load for me.
No. And I was on there this morning, and it loaded for me, so I think all is good in the world.
Okay.
What do you got? You got some climate news for us, huh?
I do have a little bit of a climate summary. I've added an additional irreversible self-reinforcing feedback loop. It's number 53 for those of you keeping score at home. According to the opening sentence of the abstract in a paper published in the July 30th, 2015 online issue of the Journal of Glaciology, quote, observations show that glaciers around the world are in retreat and losing mass, end quote. According to the final lines of the abstract, and I'll quote again, glaciological and geodetic observations, there have been about 5,200 of them since 1850, show that the rates of early 21st century mass loss are without precedent on a global scale, at least for the time period observed, and probably also in the report of history, as indicated also in reconstruction written and illustrated documents. This strong imbalance implies that glaciers in these regions will likely suffer further ice loss, even if climate remains stable. End quote. And that's a phrase I'm starting to see increasingly in the climate change literature. The bottom line, final word.
Have you heard? The Burt Cohen Show brings you the hidden truths behind the stories that affect us all and gives you the information you need to build freedom, community, and a much better world. Hi, this is Burt Cohen. Recent shows include the status of freedom of the press under President Obama. Is it time to make the Federal Reserve a public utility? Is the dream of Israel over? How is the Tea Party like the Confederacy? the true history of the National Rifle Association, and how is 2014 like 1914?
Welcome back to Nature Bats Last. We had a little bit of a technical difficulty with Guy's audio, and I don't know if Guy is back with us quite yet.
I'm back.
All right, you're back. It sounds a lot better. You were breaking up, so I would start with the climate change actually over, because about 5 seconds into it, it got real bubbly sounding.
All right. Sorry about that. I thought we were really pushing the envelope last week when we had six of us calling in by various means, but we managed to survive that, but with two of us. Depending on the two, I guess it's a little too much.
Yep.
All right. I've added an additional irreversible self-reinforcing feedback loop. It's number 53, according to the opening sentence of an abstract in a paper published in the July 30th, 2015 online issue of the Journal of Glaciology. Quote, observations show that glaciers around the world are in retreat and losing mass. And then moving on to the final lines of the abstract, quote, glaciological and geodetic observations, of which there have been about 5,200 since 1850, show that the rates of early 21st century mass loss are without precedent on a global scale, at least for the time period observed, and probably also for recorded history, as indicated in reconstructions from written and illustrated documents. This strong imbalance implies that glaciers in many regions will very likely suffer further ice loss, even if climate remains stable, end quote. And I see that phrase increasingly in the journal literature anymore as sort of the bottom line. Even if the climate remains stable today, we have triggered these events that will roll on long after we're done overheating the planet. That's what inertia leads to.
So that's the predicament.
Exactly.
Or one of them.
Right.
What doesn't Michael Mann get, or does he get it? And he's I mean, can somebody, I guess, just be, is it just fear, or is he just dishonest, or is it a little bit of both?
I think at the very least it's fear. He's
I mean,
younger.
Surely he knows these things.
Surely he knows these things. I know for a fact that he's been to my long climate change essay. Yeah. I've been in email conversations where both of us were tagged, and that's the topic of conversation. And he quotes it without really quoting it, without really mentioning where he gets the information when he does interviews. So I know he knows essentially all that I know. But he's younger than either of us. He has a child that's relatively young. He has a job that pays well and brings him lots of exposure. So I really don't know if it's patriarchy and the invisible, unrecognized privilege associated with that, or if it's fear, or if it's some combination thereof.
Or maybe it's just the fact that he does know, and he's figuring, you know, what good is it going to be to tell anybody? I mean, what good will it do? Maybe that he's justifying in his head. You know, like, if he mentions it on Bill Maher, if he says what Bill Maher says, well, there's really no reason to have him back on Bill Maher.
Well, yeah, and also, you know, an interview he did with Tom Hartmann on RT several months ago now, probably at least 8 months ago, when asked what we can do, the first thing he said was, we need to keep burning coal. Let that sink in for a minute. Here's one of the two most famous climate scientists in the world, and he says, the first thing we have to do is keep burning coal, and that's because of the sulfates that are put up into the stratosphere that serve as an umbrella. He knows that if industrial civilization fails, and of course it has to, because no civilization goes on forever, then when it does, all those sulfates that we add every day fall out of the sky within 3 days, and we lose the dimming that we've been getting from sulfates, right, and other particulates industrial activity puts up into the sky. So then he goes on to say in that interview that we have to keep burning coal until we find a way to extract carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere at scale. In other words, he's seeking fantasy technology.
Just so like he's a geoengineering guy at heart.
Right. Bingo. It seems absurd. But on one hand, it's almost impossible to understand. But on the other hand, when you look at it from the perspective of a relatively wealthy, well-respected, dare I say it, Caucasian man. It's difficult to see any other way except the way we're currently living. I mean, it goes back to that interview we just completed. There is one way to live, and this is it. And so if there's anything that's going to interrupt this and challenge patriarchy, then we don't really want to talk about that, do we?
No, and, you know, it's interesting. You know, I keep bringing up this Bill Maher show, but after he was done with Man, you know, that I don't know if you've ever watched the show, but he has a panel of guests, and some are celebrities and politicians and writers and consultants on a political spectrum. And so he had Gavin Newsom on, who's going to run for governor of California, and he had a couple conservatives on. But these were all white men and women. But Bill Maher asked the two conservatives on the show if they believed in climate change, and both of them did, but both of them made it perfectly clear that they were not willing to take action if it impacted the economy.
Right.
I mean, and they said it with a straight face, and Bill Maher kind of scoffed at it. I knew he got it on some level because he was like, you could tell he was like, really? But he didn't go far enough he could have easily said there is no economy without, you know, a biosphere.
Right. Yeah. Without a living planet, we don't really need to worry about money for much longer, do we?
No, and you know, and the one of the guys said, you know, well, we're not going to do anything until China does something because they're, you know, the biggest polluters in the world. And I'm like, listen, man.
And this is how we got here.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, it is the, you know, I can't believe on some levels because they keep saying it over and over. I don't know why I'm shocked anymore, but it really is the economy stupid, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it has been for a very long time. And, yeah, it's bizarre. And yet I was in that same position not that long ago, you know, that it was about the economy because it was about my economy, my own personal money-making endeavor.
Yeah.
And I was in a position of relative privilege and relative wealth. And you're going to threaten that? You're third.
Yeah.
I'd like to interrupt this update with a limerick from Benjamin the Donkey. Posted last week. Yeah. He posted it last week on Facebook. It's titled, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Doom. A take on how I learned to stop worrying and love the bomb. And it goes like this. I used to have worries and stress, which I never found ways to address, but will have no success in avoiding this mess. So lately, I worry much less. You know, we got to have a show where we just read his limericks.
I agree, because actually, they bring my blood pressure down. And, you know, they probably had the opposite impact on most other folks.
Yeah, I strongly suspect they do, because he's Benjamin the Doomer, really. He claims he's Benjamin the Donkey, but he can be right out there on the doom front. And I think he's hilarious, because he's telling it like it is.
He's Eeyore. Eeyore's a doomer.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Don't worry about me. I'll be all right.
Well, I mean, I read his stuff more often than I used to because – you know, you sent me a link earlier, you know, because I read headlines like, our extinction problem may be far, far worse than we think. Our extinction problem.
Right.
This is in the Huffington Post, by the way.
Right. Yeah.
New research suggests that 130,000 species are gone forever.
Yeah. Our extinction problem, I like the fact that they take ownership for it. HuffPo apparently has claimed extinction as their own problem.
Right.
Our extinction problem, no predicament here, maybe far, far worse than we think if you consider that we're driving all these species to extinction, including us. Yeah, I guess that might be something of a problem that is far, far worse than we think.
Yeah, but you know this article is not about us in the end. We're off limits for the extinction bug, so
of
to
course.
Speak. So all these other species that are, you know, are on the chopping block.
Exactly. Absolutely. Okay, I want to roll on with another one here. The August 5th, 2015 issue of Rolling Stone magazine includes an article headlined, quote, "The Point of No Return, Climate Change Nightmares Are Already Here," end quote. Finally, a mainstream media outlet concludes we've entered the abrupt stage of climate change with so-called tipping points or self-reinforcing feedback loops in the rearview mirror. That's a pretty major admission from a well-read magazine. So I was glad, I'm not sure that's the right word, I was happy to see that. I was gratified to see that.
Yeah, and on some levels it's shocking that Rolling Stone has to tell us this.
Right, yes, exactly. The scientists won't tell us.
I think old Rolling Stone does excellent work with their interviews, but, you know, it's a rock magazine.
Right.
And I don't mean geology.
Right. Now, that said, there's a guy who's writing for Rolling Stone. He contacted me about a week ago and is interviewing me and several other people, and they're not scientists. The several other people are ones who have participated in the workshop that Pauline Schneider and I put on when I was last on the East Coast. And so he's contacting several of those folks to see what their take on the situation is and how they live in light of that information. So that's kind of cool.
Planting seeds, Guy McPherson, planting seeds.
Seeds of doom, just like Bill Hicks.
Just like Bill Hicks, but different, right?
You remember? I'm just planting seeds, hoping some of them will take.
I hope we get some rain so they grow.
Yeah.
One last thing you sent me was this another article about will residents of, am I pronouncing this right, Kivalina, Alaska, be the first climate change refugees in the U.S.?
Yeah, I have no idea if you're pronouncing that correctly or not.
I'm
but
sure not.
It's pretty interesting. This is at Desdemona Despair, desdemonadespair.net. And the title is, Will the Residents of Kivalina, Alaska Be the First Climate Change Refugees in the U.S.? So it was posted just a few days ago. Apparently, we have a problem. It was no big deal when there were climate change refugees in the South Pacific. All kinds of violence over there. That's been going on for nearly a year. It was no big deal there are climate change refugees in the Middle East and Northern Africa, flooding into Western Europe. But now, we're talking about the United States.
Right, it's personal, societal tipping points for us.
Yes, this is suddenly something we need to be concerned about.
And, you know, maybe that's what I'm looking at. You know, what will it actually take, and not that we can do anything about it, but what will it take where this is the conversation on the news, day in and day out, maybe, you know, until we're gone, but I'm just wondering if something like this, oh, we have refugees now, will be maybe the start of the snowball, so to speak, rolling. No pun intended.
Well, maybe. That village sued 24 of the world's biggest fossil fuel companies for damages in 2008. In 2013, the Supreme Court refused to hear the case. So that didn't do the trick. Hurricane Sandy didn't do the trick. A lot of people asked me after Katrina, in 2005, if now people would be paying attention, and I thought, oh yeah, absolutely, it's a big deal now. And then along comes Ike and Isaac and Sandy, and it's New York's just Manhattan for crying out loud.
Right.
And yeah, people were concerned for about 20 minutes, and then Facebook came back online, and it's nothing to worry about.
Yeah, well, it seems to be the I don't know, the pattern, as I put it, hashtag pattern.
Yeah, right, and there's more. This is from a website called In These Times. This was posted just yesterday at that website, and the title is Climate Change Causing Pre-Traumatic Stress Disorder in Millennials? And so the focus here, and I don't know anything about this easing, this outlet, but maybe this is their primary demographic that they're targeting is the millennials. And they begin by comparing the Cold War and the finger on the button imminent annihilation that was headed our way. They compare what it was like in those times to millennials growing up today who have no real knowledge of the Cold War, of nuclear annihilation. And the article concludes, after interviewing a bunch of folks, including Eric Holthaus, who recently had that paper in Rolling Stone that I commented on just a few minutes ago, and who typically writes at Slate. And so they interviewed him and a bunch of millennials, and they say the big thing is climate change. Yeah. And so maybe if you're young enough to be paying attention, we are at the tipping point in societal awareness that I've been thinking was coming every day for years.
Well, let's hope so. Well, we got about 10 seconds left here, folks, so that about wraps it up for this week. We thank our guest, Daniel Quinn, author of Ishmael. And if you have any questions, please send them to our webpage. Check out GuyMcPherson.com for further updates and update on his and information on his co-authored illustrated book with Pauline Schneider called Miss Ladybug and Mr. Honeybee, A Love Story at the End of Time. And we'll see you next Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern. If you missed it, make sure to find it in the archives at PRN.fm and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again for Afrazin and his music. And, of course, again, Daniel Quinn. And remember, until next time, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.